Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. Coming up on today's program, a level playing field for all. As the Olympic Games get underway, the chaplain for sports in Westminster reflects on the doping scandals and the role of faith and ethics in sport. From Olympic skater to Franciscan sister, we hear more about Olympian values by speaking to a former Olympic speed skater who's now a religious sister. And Philippines, overlooked plight of street kids. We shine the spotlight on the plight of street kids in the Philippines and learn why it is so difficult to wean the youngsters off this dangerous way of living.
Life's a race that I'm gonna win. Yes, I'm gonna win.
It's the world's greatest sporting extravaganza. The 2012 Summer Olympic Games are now underway and will be followed by the Paralympics in late August. More than 10,000 athletes from countries around the globe are competing in the London Olympics for a coveted gold medal in their particular sport. But what is the relationship between sport and religious faith? And how can the power of sport change lives for the better? And more topically, is it a level playing field for all the athletes, given the doping scandals that have already marred these Olympics? Monsignor Vladimir Feltzman is the chaplain for sport in the Archdiocese of Westminster and also the chief executive of the John Paul Foundation for Sport. This new organisation was launched by Pope Benedict during his visit to Britain in 2010 and was inspired by John Paul's vision for sport. I asked Monsignor Vladimir what prompts athletes to go down the risky path of taking drugs to enhance their performance.
I'll never lose, and I choose to survive.
In any walk of life, and sport is a metaphor for life, people will do, if they're ambitious enough, anything to achieve their goal. It's not just in sport, it's the cheating that goes on in the bank system, the LIBOR case, etc. So in sport, there are people who want to have the edge. And in the past, it was possible to have the edge through drugs. In the past, people who got away with doping are no longer getting away with it and being caught years afterwards. Somebody who won the gold medal in Athens, because when you take a sample, you take two bottles of sample, there's two samples. One is tested immediately, the other is kept indefinitely. And in Athens, they couldn't test for this particular drug that enhanced performance. But now, last year, they caught this person. And the medal was stripped off them. And as technology improves, it's going to be harder and harder for athletes to be able to take drugs. And once the culture changes and people know nobody's taking the drugs, then they won't bother to take drugs, because at the moment, if an athlete suspects or knows that other competitors are taking drugs, they will take drugs to keep equal, because all is fair in love and war. And top athletes are enormously focused, enormously ambitious, and will do anything to get that extra edge. So it's distressing to find bankers cheating, as in sports, the judiciary, the police force. Evil is there. It's a question of combating it and seeing how one can minimize it. And as technology improves, it's getting harder and harder for people to escape. The first five people that win any event will be tested automatically. So if you've been taking drugs, don't get in the first five.
Do you think that the church does enough to speak out against doping in sport in all its various communications?
Well, it's only very recently that sport has become something that the church is very keen on. Initially, when Coubertin had the Olympic Games, the whole swathe of feeling was that sport was a bad thing and we were a Trojan horse bringing in paganism. Luckily, Pius X was keen on sport, and John Paul II was enormously keen on sport. So sport has now entered very much the centre of church's life, and that's why John Paul II Foundation is driving ahead to try to spread the virtues, the qualities, the ethos that John Paul II wanted throughout the country and eventually around the world. It's a giveaway, of course, that sport currently has no patron saint. I believe that when he is canonized, John Paul II will become patron saint of sport, and the church will take sport ever more seriously as they see it as an educational tool for developing the holistic character of a person morally, spiritually, humanly, relationally. And sport, I believe, has a huge future in the church and church using that.
What kind of valuable life lessons can sport provide, particularly when it comes to competing in a great event like the Olympic Games?
Well, the Olympic Games show that the global city, it's not a village, it's a city with very different cultures, is in fact a global community. And you can be in love with sport from any part of the world, and that brings you together, and it can unite people in ways which was aimed for originally by Coubertin when he set up the International Olympics. And his dream was world peace and unity, converting aggression from conflict to competition. So one hopes that that'll happen. There'll be a great good feeling, everybody getting to know each other and coming closer. Now, sport, as I said, is a metaphor for life. And in sport, there are many skills you need, many virtues, which are transferable. The first one is self-discipline. If you can learn self-discipline in sport, you can transfer it into life in general. In sport, you're tempted to give in. You have to overcome that temptation. So if you look at the athletes performing, if you have faith, you realize that sport can be sacramental. But we have one life, but it has the four dimensions, the pies of life, P-I-E-S, the physical, intellectual, emotional, and spiritual. And they're very closely intertwined. And what you do on one, you can transfer to the other. So as you can push yourself in the physical side, you can push yourself intellectually. When I was in Rome, I learned four words of Italian a day. At the end of a month, I knew 120. After 4 months, I could speak the language. Spiritually the same. You can improve your patience. I say to men before preparing for marriage, you listen to your wife for 10 seconds, but push it to 11 seconds and 12 seconds and 13 seconds, and eventually you'll save your marriage. The sport, if you have eyes to see it, can be very spiritual, and you can see the beauty of the Creator and the genius of the Creator in creation, which earth has given and human hands have made.
So you see, well, the Olympics and sport in general as an evangelization tool.
Yep. Spreading the gospel, whichever way one can, for people who love sport, sport is the vehicle. It's a way of helping young people especially develop themselves holistically across the spiritual as well as the physical, intellectual and emotional. So the possibility is enormous, but it's a question of seeing it as that, teaching people that you don't just look at the athlete, but think of the Creator who enabled that athlete to perform the way they are.
I was speaking there to Monsignor Vladimir Feltzman, chaplain for sport in the Archdiocese of Westminster and head of the John Paul Foundation for Sport in the UK. From Olympic speed skater to religious sister. That's the highly unusual career path of one American Franciscan sister, who's now based at a convent in northern England. Sister Catherine Hollam was formerly a world-class speed skating champion who reached the pinnacle of her success when she was placed sixth in an event at the Winter Olympics in 1998. So how and why did she decide to ditch her glittering career as Olympian skater and embrace a religious vocation instead with the Franciscan Sisters of the Renewal? I spoke to her by telephone at her convent in northern England and began by asking what, in her view, can a sporting event like the Olympics teach athletes about life lessons and moral values?
Well, sports have so much to teach us, I think, and it's a new horizon that I've actually been thinking about so much lately as the Olympics approach and reflecting on my life, that sports does have a lot to teach us about the faith, and I've learned so much through sports. Great life lessons, discipline, hard work, sacrifice, setting goals for yourself, you know, working as a team. All these kinds of things are so important in our faith, you know, that we're not an island, we're not isolated. We need others to support us in our faith, just as we need a really good coach or we need the support of our teammates. You know, we need discipline in our spiritual life as well. We need to work hard if we want to get to heaven. You know, it is an uphill battle. So it is so important to really reflect on what sports has to teach us. You know, we have this tremendous capacity to become saints. You can see the Olympians, they have a tremendous capacity to win a gold medal because they've worked so hard, sacrificed so much, been so disciplined. We have the capacity to get to heaven, the same capacity to do great things, you know. But what's more important, you know, is to become a saint and to get to heaven. And we have it in us, and sports can show us that we can do great things.
But let's go back in time for a little bit now and ask Sister Catherine when and how she first got an inkling that she wanted to become a religious sister.
Well, when I was 16 years old, I went on a pilgrimage to the Shrine of Our Lady of Fatima in Portugal. And it was there that I had a very powerful experience of hearing the Lord speak to me in prayer and calling me to be a sister. And I really look back and see it as just like a seed that the Lord planted in my heart that would bear fruit much later. But it was a very powerful experience for me.
But as you said, you put it to one side at that moment and you became an Olympic speed skater. How early in your life did you embark on that career in skating?
Well, my mother was an Olympic speed skater, an Olympic speed skating coach, and she has 4 Olympic medals. So I grew up pretty much at the rink with my mom coaching. And so I was very much involved in speed skating all throughout my life. But it was really after that pilgrimage to Fatima that I decided to make a consecration to Our Lady or ask her to pray for my speed skating career. And that's when my career just really took off. And I ended up competing on the World Cup circuit. I was the national American champion, junior world champion, breaking records. And then the following year, in 1998, I competed in the Winter Olympics in Nagano, Japan.
And how did you do there?
I placed 6th in the 3,000 meters and 7th in the 5,000 meters.
So how did you enjoy at the time that success that you achieved as an athlete in this very demanding sport?
I know I was quite younger than a lot of the other skaters that I was competing with. And I really look back on it now and when I reflect on my life and see it as it was just a pure grace and a pure gift because I was competing the year before that just with other young people my own age, other teenage girls, at an international level, but not on the World Cup circuit at all. And it was really after that summer that my career just shot off, and it was a really incredible experience. And I'm sure part of it was due to maybe growth and maturity and the workouts I was doing and everything. But I also think it was God's grace that helped me excel at that time and how he's using it now in a lot of ways to evangelize and talk about sports and talk about the faith because of that experience that I've had.
So as you said, you achieved all this success in speed skating, but then at what stage did you decide to think back to that call, as you said, for a religious vocation? Let me put it this way. Was there any particular crisis or particular event that later prompted you to once again explore the idea of a religious vocation?
Well, after I retired from speed skating in 1998, went on to study art, really my relationship with the Lord was really, really wavered a lot during that time. And so much so that by the time I graduated from art school, I had forgotten about that experience I had in Fatima, that call to be a sister. So after I graduated from art school, I was like, what next? You know, what's the next step for me? I've experienced so much already in my life. What's the next step? And that summer, by the grace of God, I ended up meeting a group of young people who were doing a pro-life walk across America, a group called Crossroads. And it was their example and their witness and their joy of living the faith and loving Jesus that was so inspiring to me and really set my heart on fire and made me really want to turn back to the Lord and have a real relationship with him. So that was a real turning point for me.
So it was after art school that you then decided to take that step, or did you spend a few more years thinking about it before you finally did?
Well, actually, I ended up joining that group of young people that were doing the walk across America, and that's where my life really turned around, where I started to develop a life of prayer and a sacramental life. And so by the time I finished that walk, we walked all the way to Toronto, Canada for World Youth Day. And it was such a powerful experience of seeing the church so alive and young and zealous, and also seeing so many young nuns and young religious sisters, that that's when my heart was really stirred to look at this again and really remember that call, that experience that I had of the Lord calling me to be a sister, and really seeing that this is the deepest desire of my heart, was to be a sister. So I actually joined the Franciscan Sisters of the Renewal just 1 year after that World Youth Day.
And do you ever practice any sports now? Do you ever feel a hankering to pick up your skates and go for a skate around the rink?
I would love to do that. I don't have my skates here in England. I haven't had too many opportunities to go skating since I've been a sister, but the couple times I have gone, it's been a lot of fun.
I was speaking to Sister Catherine Holum, a Franciscan Sister of the Renewal, who was formerly an Olympic speed skater. They are often hungry, abused, and exploited by pimps, drug gangs, and other criminals. And virtually all of them indulge in the deadly practice of sniffing glue to forget about their problems. This is the typical lot of the estimated 1 million plus kids who live on the streets of the major cities in the Philippines. The Catholic Church there is among those trying to assist these street kids, who are often seen as vermin or pests by the authorities. The Marinis brothers run a residential centre for street boys in the southern city of Davao and describe the difficulties of rehabilitating these kids into a more normal and a structured lifestyle after the freedom of living on the streets. The centre in Davao is run by Father Pablo Rambaud, who spoke to me during a recent visit to Rome.
Are they considered vermin, as pests, by the police? I mean, are they often picked up and arrested? I mean, how do people view these street kids?
Well, the local governments normally tend to remove them from the streets, sometimes in not good ways, sometimes trying to be polite and just bringing them to centers like ours. When there are moments like special feasts or celebrations in the city, police tend to come and remove all these kids from the streets, especially when tourists are coming, so, because it's not a nice view. Otherwise, they seem not to bother too much about the reality of the kids in the streets.
Okay, tell us something about the home that you helped to run in Davao. I mean, how many kids do you have there? What do you do with them? How do you try to rehabilitate them?
The center we run, it was founded in 1989 by the Marist Fathers. It's really a foundation. We run the center since 2005. It's a residence program for male street children, boys, between 8 and 14 years old. The idea is to have a transition place. So we don't understand the center as a permanent orphanage or something like this. It's a place where the children that are actually living in the street can find a home where they can start living a more regular or normal life. When they enter in that dynamic is when we are ready to either bring them back home, because many of these kids have families, even if they are living outside of the families. So when the situation in the family is good enough, we bring them back home because it's the best place for a child. If not, unfortunately, many times it's not possible, then we try to move them to other centers that can offer them a more regular program for life. So we see as ourselves as a transition place. They can live with us between 1 to 3 years the most.
And are they getting an education during that time?
One of the main things we try to do is to put them back in the school system. So we don't provide that part, but we send them to the public school, the nearby public school. So really our house is just a house. So what they don't have, a home. Then they attend the public school with the other kids, and we follow them, the process of education, how are they doing. So that's the main part of the program, to try to help these kids to go back to a regular, normal life of a kid. because the problem is living in the streets is that the life is very irregular, so they don't have schedules, and of course for them it's very difficult to pass from that kind of life in which I do what I want when I want to a more organized life, more regular with a schedule,
structured.
Structure. So it takes time for them. It's not easy, that process.
Do you find, in fact, because they say, don't they, that the children really love the freedom, as you say, that they have on the streets, do you find that you get quite a lot of kids who can't make the adjustment and drop out, and what percentage is it?
It's interesting because what I have observed in these past years is that it's very difficult for a kid to enter directly from the street in our center. That's why our center is an open center, meaning some of the kids come, stay with us for 1-2 weeks. They cannot make it at the beginning, so entering in a structured life is very difficult. So they go back to the streets, but they know that they have that place, so they can come back. So maybe after 1-2 months, this boy come back. Maybe he's able that time to make it for 1 month, but then they go back to the streets and then come back. And finally, my experience is that many of them, after, let's say, 1 year of this coming in and out, they are able to enter in the process. Normally also depends on the age. Boys already 12, 13 years old, they start realizing that the street cannot offer them anything. When they are still 8, 9, they just enjoy a lot the freedom of the street. So they cannot measure really the importance of the other part. No? I cannot give percentage, but of course there is unfortunately a big number of boys that cannot make it.
Do you try to enlist the support of the parents, try to persuade the parents that this is the best, better future for their children rather than scavenging a living off the streets?
Yes, this is the other big piece of the program we run, to work with the family. So our social worker, normally one of the first things she does is to contact the families when we can, because sometimes it's not possible. The kid is many years in the street, and he's not able to remember even where the family comes. But normally it's possible, and that's the part, to connect with the family, to try to see what's the family situation, so that we can reestablish this connection between the boy and the family. Many times the real problem is either there is no real financial capacity in this family to help these kids. So they have many kids and they say, no, I cannot send my boys, all of them, to the school or whatever. No? In other cases, many cases, the problem is really our broken families, new couples, new kids coming from the new couple. So these kids coming from the first couple has felt that they are not loved at home, so they left. So in those cases, it's very difficult to try to convince the family to have them back, because it's like they are already out of that family. So that's the difficulty many times.
Is the problem of street children worsening in the Philippines? Are more and more kids going onto the streets with, you know, particularly with the financial crisis and perhaps, you know, growing social inequalities?
No, I don't think so. I don't see a worsening. In fact, the financial crisis is affecting more the Western world. So the situation in the Philippines is the same. It's not worse.
Now, these kids that are in the street, presumably they're begging, they're engaged in petty theft, prostitution, sniffing glue. Is that how they get by?
One of the biggest problems we have is with the sniffing glue. So that is what really...
How common is it?
I would say 99% of the street children have been involved some one time or the other in that.
And they do it so they don't feel the hunger, right?
They do to forget their problems. They do that. Mm. So that's the part, one of the most difficult things to have them in the center, because they want to go back, because they want to continue sniffing glue, because it's an addiction, really. And the other part, the part of the money they get, when that's also more attractive for them. They like to have their own money. When they are in the center, they cannot have their own money. No? In fact, one of the biggest problems to rehabilitate them is that they are very attracted. So they have a lot of callings from the street, from these gangs and groups, drug lords, calling them because they receive money, of course, for these things. And also the law protects them in the sense that minors cannot go to jail. That's a new law in the Philippines. But that has become a very complicated issue, because now many of these drug groups are using minors just for a little money, but for them it's a lot, for the kids. For little money, they start trafficking because they cannot be put into jail. So there is a lot of attractions in the street for these kids.
Coming back to the glue sniffing, how badly does that damage their health? What does it do to them?
But mainly they got dizzy and they start laughing. Of course, they forget everything, what's all the problems that's going around. So
it's a sense of euphoria.
Yes, but the truth, for what I've heard from some doctors that work with us, is that that really affects deeply their brains and very fast. I have known the case of two boys, former boys from our center. I have met them later in the rehabilitation center, and they were already like out of their minds. But this is permanent damage. No, it's not a...
So they risk permanent brain damage.
Yes, is what the doctor says. So after a few years, regularly using glue, it's permanent damage.
Okay, could you now, if you could share with us an anecdote of one or two of the boys you come across whose case was either particularly bad at the beginning and then how they really improved, or some particularly tragic or inspirational case?
We have a case, he's still now with us. He arrived, I think it was 2.5 years ago. He was at that time 9 years old, I think. When he first came, my first impression and the social worker impression was that he was mentally retarded. He was practically unable to speak in his own language, very difficult to understand what he was trying to say, very aggressive. He was continuously throwing whatever was nearby, especially chairs, just throwing everything. At one point, I talked with the social worker, said maybe we have to really bring this boy to the mental hospital because it was very difficult. Well, we kept him for a while, and I can say that now, well, later on, like 1 year after, we were able to put him in a school, in a special school for special cases. But slowly, slowly, this boy started becoming more able to relate with his own peers, because at the beginning, he was not talking at all with the other kids. And after 2 years now, 2 years and a half, this boy is now in a regular school, improving very fast. He has very good friends now among the boys in the center. You see, this boy really was, of course, not mentally retarded. It was a problem of non-development, no, of his capacities, because he was being abandoned. So it was isolated. So he was not able to learn how to speak and how to relate with people. And all this tension and anger within him was expressed simply by throwing all these things. When he found himself in an environment in which he was respected, recognized, addressed, talked to, he started developing his capacities of relationship. And now he's a very nice boy. Is one of these cases you said, this is good, what we are doing here.
Can you tell us some of the success stories of boys who maybe managed to go on and go to university or something after that? Do you have many of those cases?
Not many, but we have some, fortunately. Recalling a case, this boy was a very clever boy. He was the best in his when he graduated in primary school. So we got for him a scholarship in high school, in a very demanding high school. He went through, and he's now studying engineering in one university, public university in Davao. So it's one of these cases that you see it's worth the effort.
I was speaking to Father Pablo Rambaud, superior of the Marinus Brothers in the Philippines. Well, that's all for today from me, Susie Hodges, here at Vatican Radio's English programme. But we hope you have enjoyed listening to us. We'll be on the air again at the same time tomorrow. And don't forget, you can always find our programmes at the click of a mouse on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. Laudato Jesus Christus.